Hey, I'm Francis Lam, and this is our mini-podcast, Splendid Table Selects. Our presenting sponsor is Bob's Red Mill. They're an employee-owned company that's offered organic, gluten-free, stone-ground products for decades, and they're experts at making healthy taste amazing. All right, welcome to 2019. But today on the show, we're actually going to take a little detour back in time to the 70s, to the beginning of the American Restaurant Revolution. It was a time when young, talented chefs started opening restaurants that didn't feel bound to tradition, and it was when cooking first became cool. The writer Andrew Friedman runs a website about chefs called Tokeland, and he says the energy at that time was just palpable. And he wrote a book about it called Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, and our friend Russ Parsons talked to him. Have a listen.
Now, in the book, you focus primarily on the restaurant scenes in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Each of those share some similarities, but each is also very different. What were the similarities and differences that you found?
Well, for me, being focused really on the chefs more than anything, I think it's very easy to identify what we might call the archetypical New York, Bay Area, and Los Angeles chefs of the time. I mean, for me, in the Bay Area, food was largely something, or a pursuit of food was largely something that grew out of the politics of that region, that grew out of the free speech movement. The number of people who had either graduated from UC Berkeley or dropped out of UC Berkeley, had marched for free speech, had marched against the war, and sort of naturally migrated from other pursuits into wanting to cook, it makes up a disproportionate number of the early professional cooks in that area. In Los Angeles, I think it was by far the people who were the most creative, who were the least sort of tethered to traditional food, traditional French food for the most part, people who were doing the most exciting, groundbreaking food. The restaurants to me were the most radically different in their design and tone. This notion of, I think, restaurants as entertainment, I mean, it's very easy, I guess, but I don't think it's untrue to say that some of this is because the proximity and the involvement of Hollywood, both in the seats in the dining room, and eventually some of those people became investors in the restaurants. And then in New York, I really think there were two populations. I think there was this largely sort of blue-collar, agricultural class of young cooks. These were the people who went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, who wanted to master French cuisine, who were less concerned, at least early in their career, with the sort of idea of creating a personal repertoire, and really just more concerned with sort of pleasing their French masters, to be honest. A lot of them eventually became more creative. And then there was this very small subset of chefs in New York who I think were actually very similar to the LA chefs of the time. I refer to them as the five couples, but Barry Wine and Susan Wine, who had the Quilted Giraffe, would be a very prominent example. David and Karen Waltuck, who had Chanterelle, Terrell, would be another prominent example. And these were people very much influenced by Nouvelle Cuisine, who were doing much more expressive, personalized, creative cooking. And that's how I break up those cities, broadly speaking.
Now, who were some of the key players who paved your way in telling the story?
The most useful interviews for me were people who got around. You know, this was a time, it's very hard for people to understand this today with the tools we have literally in all of our pockets, you know, Instagram and Twitter and even the ability to go on websites and look at slideshows for restaurants anywhere in the world. Most people, at least in the first half of the story I tell, were very much kind of bound to their area. They didn't travel much. A lot of them didn't have the money to travel much. A lot of them weren't really aware that there was this kind of thing happening in other cities around the country. So people who did get around were the most useful to me. So for example, the first interview I did for this book was Jonathan Waxman, who today is still a very prominent guy. He has Barbudo in New York City, and he has other restaurants around the country and in Canada that he's either, well, mostly he's a consulting chef to. But Jonathan had cooked early in his career at Chez Panisse, had migrated down to Los Angeles and cooked at Michael's in Santa Monica, which is a hugely important restaurant, and then came to New York and opened what many consider, I don't love this term myself, but the first California cuisine restaurant in New York. So he lived and worked in all three of those hubs. And I think he was in each of them at the time they were each sort of popping, you know, and kind of becoming what we now look at historically as the cities that they were at the time. Along the same lines, Michael McCarty, the owner of Michael's Santa Monica and later Michael's New York, who had come from the East Coast, moved to Los Angeles, but was very much on the move in those days. He was traveling around the country a lot to see what was happening in American food and wine, and was also very much a connector. He put on a very important event that happened at the Stamford Court Hotel, one of the first collaborative chef dinners of its kind in 1983. And Michael, again, was able to speak sort of from a bird's eye view of what was happening around the country. And then on the East Coast, or starting from the East Coast, somebody like Drew Naporant, the restaurateur, who, again, very well traveled, who had sort of a insatiable appetite for information, still does today. He's still out just about every night of the week at whatever event or opening is going on, and was able to, these people were all able to contextualize what was happening, not just around the country in food and in restaurants, but these are all fairly sophisticated people, generally speaking, who could put a lot of this stuff into historical context for me, which was invaluable.
What role did privilege play in the great American culinary boom?
Well, for those who did come from a privileged background, or a relatively privileged background, there were a couple of things, and I think a lot of them now, it's easy to romanticize it, although I think it's just the way it was. There's a chef by the name of Stephanie Linus. She's now mostly a writer, but she cooked in New York. She actually cooked for Jonathan Waxman at Jams and I think some of his other restaurants. And in our interview, I remember very distinctly sitting with her, and she said to me, has anyone brought up with you yet the notion of people taking time to find themselves, right? And she really hit those two words with a lot of emphasis. And this notion in the 70s that you would take time to find yourself, to knock around, to go backpacking around Europe, to just kind of dabble in a lot of different jobs, to take the luxury of time, was something that I don't think we necessarily think of today. Everyone today seems to be in a mad dash for the finish line of their career. And, you know, I have young children. They're already being kind of guided by a lot of advice columnists and bloggers and whatnot to figure out what they want to do really early and where do they want to go to college and to be consumed by their GPA. And I just think this is not the way the world was. So that was one thing. The other thing, if we're honest, and, you know, this is something that has been talked about a lot recently, a lot of kitchens, and it's less so now because of labor laws and regulations, but a lot of early jobs in kitchens are jobs that you literally don't get paid for or get paid next to nothing to do. So a rite of passage for a lot of people of this era, especially those from, let's say, Chicago East to New York and Boston and whatnot, was to go overseas or to come to New York to work what was called a stage or an unpaid term in a kitchen, and you got paid in knowledge. That was the notion. Well, not everybody can work for free. You know, you do need to eat. So I think that's something that's very overlooked. I think it's one of the things, in some respects, that accounts for the preponderance of Caucasians, you know, in this story. I just think you had to have been able to indulge yourself in that way. Although I'm oversimplifying slightly. You know, I alluded a minute ago to those blue-collar and agricultural kids who kind of populated the Culinary Institute in the French kitchens of New York in the early 80s. Those people were basically poor. I mean, Charlie Palmer, who today has an empire of restaurants, hotels, and whatnot, he freely says that he was a poor kid from Smyrna, New York, who fell in love with cooking in a home ec class. So there is that group who were willing to work for almost nothing and were used to living on almost nothing. And we're just really scrappy and made it work.
You know, the whole notion of celebrity chefs has been kind of controversial almost from the beginning. I found a clipping from Ruth Reichel in 1989, and she wrote a story headlined "Goodbye to the Celebrity Chef." She wrote, "The dinner party is over. The season of the celebrity chef is coming to an end. It was a phenomenon of the 80s. The era of adulation is over." Almost 30 years later now, why does the notion of rock star chef, why does that remain so attractive to us?
It's so funny to me. I first have to say that Ruth is very upfront about saying, I've brought that piece up with her, and she said, you know, how wrong was I? It is pretty funny to hear that now, because things were just getting warmed up. First of all, for the chefs, I think at a time when the public is more fickle than they ever have been, you know, they really kind of take what restaurants have to give and then discard them, you know, as soon as the next crop comes along the next season and maybe never go back. I think for chefs, the idea of fame is a commodity. I think it's almost irresponsible these days for a chef who's capable of being famous to not be, because it will extend the life of your restaurant. It may very well literally extend your career. In terms of the public, you know, we lost Tony Bourdain this spring, and I think this world that he first sort of shined a light on, these very distinct characters that really kind of run the gamut. You know, I was talking about that group that did a dinner at San Francisco years ago that Michael McCarty put together. You know, and I've always privately referred to that group sort of as the Avengers of cooking. You know, there's, you know, the personalities are so diverse. And I think people are still very drawn to that. And I also think there's an element of why we're drawn to athletes or why we're drawn to singers. I think there's this element of, you know, you see a chef do what they can do with a knife or create what they can create on a plate. And to most of us, there's something almost superhuman about that and unattainable about that. And I think that remains fascinating to people.
You know, of course, you know, given the title of the book, we kind of have to address the elephant in the room these days. And that is that all of the recent revelations about bad behavior in professional kitchens. Why has this been so prevalent, do you think? And how much does the whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll attitude have to do with it?
Well, I'm sort of a dissenting or minority viewpoint on this whole topic. You know, that title, which seemed so damn clever at the time, and now it's like an albatross, but that title, you know, that term that it's based on, sex and drugs and rock and roll, that is not a reference to harassment or abuse. You know, one of the terms that comes around in this era that I wrote about was free love, right? That was the sexual revolution. That was my reference point. And I think, you know, a lot of people have connected the sort of swagger of the rock star chef to these stories that are coming out now. I don't necessarily think these things are unique to the kitchen. I mean, to me, it's a Rubicon to cross between being a supremely confident, swaggery, maybe arrogant chef and forcing yourself on somebody or treating somebody in a horrible way. And to me, really, it's the combination of alcohol or drugs, let's call it substance, and power, which sometimes just comes with fame, but sometimes it just comes with being the boss, that is responsible for a lot of these stories we're hearing, not just around the restaurant business, but in all industries. So I really, maybe I'm naive, but I do not directly link somebody being one of these chefs who was all of a sudden getting famous automatically with the rest of it. You know, a lot of these people are good people. A lot of them are some of the most generous people you will ever meet. Some of them are on the right side of this issue today. So I just think it's a very complicated topic, and I almost think it has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
Now, earlier you had talked about the differences among the three main culinary hubs in the early days of the American culinary revolution. Do you find the same range of difference now, or are things becoming more similar than they were before?
No, I think it's the exact opposite today. I think the idea that back in the days that I write about in the book, you needed to travel somewhere to experience a restaurant. I can't tell you how many people said to me, you know, they got on a plane, they had heard about, say, Jams in New York City where Jonathan Waxman was, or they heard about Stars in San Francisco, or they had heard about, you know, what Alice Waters was doing up at Chez Panisse, or what Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Fenniger were doing at City Restaurant or later Border Grill in Los Angeles. And they didn't really know what they were going to experience until they walked in the door. And it was almost, in a good way, like a bucket of cold water, right? They as they took it all in, the design, the service, the vibe, the food, everything about it. And today, and it's just a different time. I really don't like to sound cantankerous about this because I'm not, because it's the nature of things to change. You know, you can go on a website like Eater, or we have in New York Grub Street, and other sites, you can see a slideshow of restaurants, you can see a menu, you can see the chef demo their signature dish. You can almost feel like you've been to the restaurant without leaving your desk in whatever city you happen to be in. And that's not just true of, you know, you mentioned the three main hubs of the book. That's true around the country, and that is now true globally. You know, a chef in Los Angeles can take a phone out of their pocket and see a new dish that just went up on the pass in Copenhagen and maybe decide to imitate it. And that, it, like I say, it's the way it is, but I think that is responsible for a lot of what I think of as the sameness in food that we're seeing around the world. I also think it's why the young chefs today who are mining their own heritage, or the heritage of others in some cases, you know, these people who are exploring Korean food, like Hoonie Kim in New York City is, for example. It's almost like a battle for the soul of the plate to me. You know, I think these restaurants that are coming from a personal place, the way they did in this time I write about in the book, are in direct opposition to the people who are sort of, whether or not they realize they're doing it, just sort of ticking off the boxes of what's current.
Andrew Friedman, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Russ. I really enjoyed it.
That was Russ Parsons with Andrew Friedman, author of Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Learn more about Andrew and his book by heading to our website, splendidtable.org, or you can follow his work at tokeland.com. And if one of your resolutions this year is to cook more Mondays to Fridays, you can sign up for our email newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and we'll send you a great new quick recipe every week. Huge thanks to our presenting sponsor, Bob's Red Mill. If you, like them, believe that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, check out their muesli. They have three gluten-free mueslis that come in single-serving cups. You can soak them with yogurt overnight, or just crack them open, pour milk, and go for it. It's power-packed nutrition on the go. For that and tons of other whole grains and foods for health, visit bobsredmill.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Francis Lamb, and we'll be back in your feed again soon.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.